Hey, it's Joe. Today I have a special episode, one that feels very important to me personally, and I hope meaningful to you as well. Any of us who have been in this game for a while trying to extend our time in life as a strong athlete knows that one of the most important factors in success in this effort is managing body composition. And obviously, we're not talking about looking good in the mirror. We're talking about not having too much body fat, especially in our organs, and not having too little muscle mass. We need sufficient muscle mass to have the strength to move our body the way we want to live the life that we want. If counting calories worked, then nobody would have any problems with this. But of course, it doesn't work. If you've been following the Wise Athletes podcast, you'll know I've had many experts on the show talking about controlling body fat, managing body composition, and all of these guests have provided important information to me that have helped me in getting my own body composition better under control, but yet none of that actually succeeded entirely in giving me the control that I needed without too much willpower or suffering. And that is why I am so excited about this conversation that I had with Dr. Ted Naiman. You'll know the name Dr. Ted Naiman. He is the author of the PE diet that was focusing on protein leverage as a lever of managing satiety. And I have been a long believer in using a protein-heavy diet for many benefits, but that wasn't enough, not for me, and maybe not for other people. And maybe this is why Dr. Ted Naiman wrote another book just recently published called Satiety Per Calorie, where he goes into more depth about all of the levers that we can employ in order to control our eating without suffering, without being hungry all the time, or without leveraging our willpower, or using extreme diets in order to manipulate how our bodies function. And this conversation that I had with Dr. Naiman was very powerful. I have begun employing these tools now, and I am already seeing some results. My efforts to get my visceral fat down to as close to zero as possible that have essentially eluded me for the last year is now starting to come into the range that I have been desiring. I'm going to be getting another DEXA scan in the next month or so in order to confirm that. In any case, this has been very powerful for me, and I expect that any of you who are suffering from some of these same issues as me will find this conversation very useful. All right then, let's talk to Dr. Naiman. Dr. Ted Naiman, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Oh, hi, man. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
I've been following you for a long time. I was very impressed with your protein book. I mean, I've been a protein guy, really, for a long time. And I really thought that you were onto something, and then I wasn't at all surprised when the whole protein thing kind of blew up and everybody kind of got onto it. I mean, among the reasons that I always ate a lot of protein was I always felt like it was satiating, you know, that it would help me to not eat as much, and then my body would burn more of the calories that I ate in order to turn that protein into energy that I could, you know, fuel my body with. So it just made a lot of sense to me. But over the years, I have kind of found that it really isn't enough. There's more to the satiety game than just getting enough protein. And so I was really excited when you came out with another book, which I have read, on satiety. So welcome to the show, man.
Oh, thanks, man. Thanks for checking out the book. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. So look, before we dive into the weeds on this topic, give our audience a little bit about, you know, who you are and your background and why do you know about this? And why should we listen to you?
Got it. Okay. Yeah. I'm a primary care doc. I've been in clinical practice for about 25 years. So yeah, either I'm super old or I started when I was, you know, Doogie Howser, 10 years old, one of those two. I'm not going to tell you which one, but okay. I'm here in Seattle. I'm at a major medical center, actually the number one hospital right now in Seattle. And I'm a physician there in outpatient, just general medicine. And my whole career, I've been super geeked out on diet and exercise and the effects they have on health and body composition and metabolic syndrome and insulin resistance and all these kinds of things. So I'm always just researching the absolute heck out of anything that has to do with diet and exercise and health outcomes, especially anything that would be practical or actionable or something that I could talk to a patient about in a 15-minute time slot or whatever tiny piece of time that I have. So pretty much my whole career is just like researching and implementing on a practical level diet and exercise for just body composition, health, metabolic health, and anything under that umbrella. And that's kind of how I got here. And so I'm pretty much into every single like diet religion, why they're good or bad, you know, what's driving all of the health stuff that we're seeing out there. And so I wrote these two books, The PE Diet, just basically looking at protein leverage and sort of educating people about what that is and why it's important. And then, like you said, I just recently wrote Satiety Per Calorie, which kind of goes beyond protein leverage to look at energy density and fiber and all these other satiety per calorie factors. And I'm just trying to be, you know, basically give people a big picture look at how eating works and then how it breaks and how you can fix it.
Well, awesome. And I don't think you mentioned, but I think it's worth mentioning that, you know, you personally, I assume just by, I can't, you have a shirt on at the moment, but I have seen pictures of you where you have very, very decent muscle mass and very low body fat. And so you must have some personal experience with this, trying to control how much you eat versus how much you burn and things like that. So all of it sort of fit together, your professional, maybe your personal interests, all of that. Is that true?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I would say ever since I wrote the PE Diet 5 years ago, I've been able to pretty easily maintain just under 10% body fat and kind of be sort of lean, permalean all the time, which was definitely a goal of mine. And I was not able to do that until I kind of figured all of this stuff out. I will admit that the fact that I'm just surrounded by super sick people all day who got there via diet and exercise probably pushes me towards the like being a little uptight about, you know, staying healthy.
So yeah, pretty boring at a dinner party.
I am. I'm super boring. I am not fun at parties. Nobody invites me ever. So but you know, like it'll hopefully pay off in a little bit of a health span, maybe. But yeah, so that's exactly right. I am trying to practice what I preach and lead by example. And I figure, you know, if I haven't been able to do it myself, how in the hell am I supposed to expect anybody else to do it?
Yeah. I try very hard in this area. And I succeed more than I fail, but I got plenty of failure in there. And so, you know, and I've really tried to adopt a lot of the things that are in your book and even more as I just battle this, you know, wage war with myself. You know, I just am not in control of myself all of the time. And the times that I'm not, I'm definitely overeating. And so, I also want to say that in all of the many episodes that I have done, I've been doing this for almost 5 years now, the number one variable lever of, you know, health, of athletic performance, of longevity, of all, you know, all the things that I care about and my audience cares about is body composition. You know, which is kind of a, maybe sounds like a ego word, but what it really means is nothing about ego. It's you got to have enough muscle mass to live the life you want, and you can't have too much fat mass that's, you know, impeding your muscle development or, you know, how your organs function. And I think everybody knows that it's much easier to control your calorie balance by what you eat than by how much you exercise. 1,000 calories could be like 15 minutes of eating, maybe less, depending on what you're eating. But 1,000 calories of exercise, that's a lot. So you really have got to control it on the diet side, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Box of Krispy Kremes, 2,000 calories. Running a marathon, 2,000 calories. You do the math. It's that simple.
Yes, exactly. All right, so I don't really know the best way to go through all of this, and you may know the best way. But I was thinking that what we would start by doing is just trying to pull from you. You could explain to us what are all of these mechanisms that our bodies have, and why, you know, do we speculate that the body has it for manipulating us? Right? I said I'm not in control of myself. Something's in control of me some of the time. Why does my body have these instincts and these levers that it can pull on me to make me change my mind about what I want in the moment so that I eat more or maybe I eat less or maybe I stop eating because I think that, you know, especially when I was younger, my body weight didn't really change that much. It hardly mattered what I ate. I always ate. So, I mean, if I had stopped eating, it probably would have mattered. But as long as I ate food, it wasn't like I would get overweight by eating more, my body would just kind of burn it off somehow. So there was some homeostasis mechanism or set of them going on that would keep my body in kind of a range. And that seems to be breaking as I get older. But why does our body do that? And how does it do that?
Okay, yeah. There's a couple things going on under the hood that a lot of people aren't aware of. Number one, protein leverage. Okay, so unbeknownst to almost everyone on Earth, every single animal on the planet, insects, fish, birds, all mammals, eat until they get enough protein. And only then do they stop eating. Full stop. If you have food in your environment, you won't stop eating until you've consumed adequate protein. And that is a huge big deal, and nobody's ever heard of it. And a big percentage of the obesity epidemic is simply protein dilution with refined carbs and refined fats. So hunter-gatherer, worldwide hunter-gatherer estimates is about 30% of calories from protein. And if you eat till you get enough protein, then you stop eating, you're eating way less calories. Right now, over the past 60 or 70 years of the obesity epidemic, the protein percentage of the standard American diet has just steadily fallen. It's down, you know, around maybe 14, 13, some estimates 12.5% protein by calories, and you're still eating to get the same amount of protein. So, you know, just think about how many more calories you have to eat when your food is that protein dilute. And so that's just a huge driver that nobody's really aware of. And that's just a huge big deal.
So let's say 2,500 calories times 13%, did you say? Anyway, that's just a rough number. Mm-hmm. And if I divide, now actually it's not 2,500 calories. You were saying that so what's an amount of protein? I guess I need to start with, what's an amount of protein that people need? And if they don't get enough, they're going to eat more.
Right. So your average American, female eating upper 60s, maybe 70 grams of protein a day. Males, you know, upper 80s, maybe 90 grams of protein a day. So if you look at it all, you know, average human, basically not gender neutral, it's like 75 grams of protein or something like that. And so if you think about how many calories you have to eat from a 30% protein diet to get that much protein versus a 12.5% protein, it basically is half. It's like it's 2x the calories. You have to eat twice as many calories. At 15% protein, you have to eat twice as many calories to get the same absolute amount of protein that you do at 30% protein. Is it really that simple? Okay. Basically, you double the protein percent, you eat half the calories. It's pretty much how it works. Okay. And so protein dilution with refined carbs and refined fats is a huge, huge driver, passive driver of the obesity epidemic. Because you're just eating until you're not hungry. I mean, it's very, very simple. It's all in the background. You're not even aware of it. That's one of the factors. It's probably the single biggest one, which is why I wrote the PE diet. Just pretty much it's all about protein percentage of your diet and how it's the single most important factor when it comes to ad lib caloric consumption, or just how many calories you're going to eat when you're just eating until you're not hungry anymore, which is basically what all animals do as long as they have food nearby.
All right. So there's more to the story than just calories. There are certain nutrients that the body has a sense for and has a need for, and it'll turn on these signals that we interpret as hunger, as if you're not getting them, whether it's too few calories or it's too little protein, or maybe it's other things too, like maybe you've got too little sodium or something like that, or the other minerals that or macronutrients that come into this play.
Yeah, so humans have a very specific appetite for protein and for carbohydrate and for fat. So your body is looking for all those things. There is also a specific appetite for sodium. There's possibly a bit of a signal for a few other minerals as well, like calcium and iron. And people who are iron deficient end up eating more nails and crap like that.
Crazy.
And, you know, and people who are calcium deficient, it'll just be like gnawing on chalk, sticks of chalk or something. And so there is a little bit of appetite for some of the other ones. Not really for every single micronutrient, ironically, although sometimes if you're low on something, you will just eat a little bit more in general, and we're not entirely sure how all those mechanisms work. But yeah, you have absolutely a specific appetite for protein, fat, and carbohydrate. For the longest time, everybody researching obesity, it was like, it's got to be carbs or fat, because protein is very, very small. Like, protein's the smallest percentage worldwide. It's like really no higher than 14 or 15% anywhere on Earth. And carbs and fats are much, much bigger. You know, like fat's, you know, basically at 30% everywhere, you know, 20 to 30% at least. Carbs are, you know, much higher almost globally. So you're talking about protein being the very smallest segment with a very little deviation. Like if you look at a very low fat country like Japan, and a very high fat country like, you know, Germany or somewhere in Scandinavia, you know, they're maybe eating a 2x percentage of fat, but the protein percent is exactly the same in both of these locations. And so everyone was like, well, protein can't be it because it's so fixed and such a small amount. But it's exactly because it's so tiny and conserved everywhere that it's actually exerting the biggest leverage over everything else. Okay. So that's why the protein leverage is absolutely huge. And it's fairly new discovery. I mean, in the past 20 years, and nobody's ever heard of it. So it's kind of like a, should be a household term, that it, but it's not, which is kind of too bad.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to get into all of this, but where I was leaning was that the body is trying, as I understand it, the body is trying to keep us within a fairly narrow range. I mean, it is trying to get all the nutrients that it needs, the protein and whatever else it has to get. But it is trying to essentially maintain our weight. And it doesn't want us to get overweight or underweight. And probably it prioritizes eating enough more than it prioritizes not eating too much, because that probably was a shorter term risk to an organism. But something has changed in our environment. You know, how easy it is to get at food, how little work you have to do to get it, the constant reminders of food everywhere. You know, you're driving down the street and you go by 400 fast food restaurants. You know, there's always food at the office. I mean, I can't escape the snacks at the office. That takes more willpower than anything else. Even things like people get dehydrated and then they eat because they think they're hungry, but they're thirsty, things like that. So I'm sure that you put a lot of thought into this. What has happened? Why are we all getting fat?
So, okay, the lower bound to body weight is much more tightly protected and conserved in humans, right? So like starving to death, every single winter you could potentially starve to death. Anytime there's a famine, you could starve to death. Anytime anything happens to your food supply, which is pretty delicate, you're going to starve to death. So your body does not want your body fat getting below a certain point. And all mammals, this, as your fat cells shrink down and you lose your fat source, if you get low enough, your leptin falls. And low leptin is just this powerful signal to every animal on earth to just eat like crazy. So your body is not going to let you get too thin. And so this is a very powerful driving force to not get too thin. Part of that is if you come across something as a hunter-gatherer that's a really high energy density carb like honey, or a high energy density fat like bone marrow, or a very rare and prized, a combination of high energy density carbs and fats together, like nuts or mammalian milk or something, you're just going to absolutely eat as much as you can of it. Almost like binge eating is part of the master plan, because you're probably not going to encounter this very often. And it can very, very easily allow you to store enough fat to not die of starvation in the winter. So we have this hedonic drive where if you taste something that really lights up your brain, because you can tell it's just an amazing source of calories, you're just going to binge eat it. And that's normal. That's expected. That is what hunter-gatherer Homo sapiens are supposed to do. If your hunter-gatherers came across like the Krispy Kreme donut tree, they are going to eat all the donuts on the tree, you know, at once. And so this is normal behavior.
You're just not supposed to find a donut tree every day.
Right. The other problem is the upper bound, right? Well, like what keeps humans from getting too fat? Really, the only upper bound is predation. The reason you don't want to get too fat is because you're going to get eaten by a saber-toothed tiger, and you're going to fall victim to predation if you can't outrun a predator. We kind of eliminated that, more or less, in modern society. I mean, as soon as the zombie apocalypse hits, especially if they're fast zombies, like, you know, like 28 years later or whatever, when the fast zombie apocalypse hits, totally going to take care of the obesity epidemic, like overnight.
Well, we got that to look forward to. Good.
We don't have that upper bound yet. So when the rage virus hits, we'll all be like running for our lives. But right now there's kind of no specific upper bound. And so we've got this tightly, universally defended, extremely well defended lower bound, and kind of really no upper bound. So that's part of what has been going on. But like you said, the donut tree is everywhere now instead of just a once in a lifetime find. And that is definitely part of the problem.
I don't even have to go outside to find the donut tree. It's in my refrigerator and it's always stocked.
Oh, I've got Krispy Kreme on Uber Eats. I mean, I can literally press one button and not even get off the couch.
Unbelievable. All right. So anyway, this is just kind of funny. Everybody already knows that it's very hard. Anybody who is even succeeding knows how hard it is to stay succeeding, because, you know, you hit the holidays and you go, oh, I'm just going to indulge. And then you're off your thing. And it's 4 months later, you put on 15 pounds and you're like, oh, what happened? So it just happens so quickly. But the good news is that we do have mechanisms. The mechanisms which trick us to overeat kind of suggest ways that we can behave that help us to not overeat, which is what your book was all about. So I think that we should go through that. What are the, you know, these big ideas, the big buckets of ideas, and maybe some specifics to help people, you know, understand what we're talking about, that really can make a difference? We talked about a lot of protein, so let's move on to the other things.
Got it. Okay, so protein's the first one. There's two things that happen in your body every day. You eat until you get enough protein. Great. The other one is your body has to guess how many calories you've eaten, right? I mean, like, you know, you eat like a million calories a year, and at each meal, you stop eating way before you've digested it all, and all the calories have gotten in your bloodstream and gotten stored anywhere. So your body literally has to guess every time you eat if you've had enough calories or not. So your body is, you know, tuned over, you know, 1.5 million years of evolution to like kind of detect the weight and volume of food you just ate through oral processing and chewing, swallowing, stomach distension, small intestinal distension, all these other clues besides just protein in your bloodstream. You basically get all these clues while you're eating. And shortly after that, let you know, okay, I think I ate enough food, right? This feels right. I think I'm going to stop. You're totally guessing. But the weight and volume is an incredibly big deal. Basically, humans eat about 3 to 4 pounds of food every single day, somewhat independent of however the hell many calories were in that food. And you're just going to eat 3 or 4 pounds of food a day. If you feed humans the same food, but one is secretly 2x the caloric density and the other one's 1x the caloric density, like you're using just fillers or fiber or water or something in one, and, you know, and you're using just actual carbs and fat calories in the other, you can actually watch people eat the same weight and volume of food and have 2x the calories with this food and 1x the calorie with this food, even though they feel just as full with both, they're just as satisfied with both, they both are just as tasty, blah, 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 blah. So this energy density thing is a huge big deal. Basically, you're going to eat a certain weight and volume of food. Now, how do you increase the weight of food without calories? The number one factor is water, the water content of the food. But it's basically the water to oil spectrum. If you have a food that's just all water and no oil, very low calories for the same weight. If you have a food that's all oil and no water, very, very many calories for the same weight. The volume part is fiber. So if I eat something with no fiber, if I just eat crackers, volume's pretty low. If I eat raw broccoli, volume's pretty high. So you're getting volume from fiber, weight from water, and you're eating until you get enough weight and volume. So that is why fiber percentage of carbs and energy density are huge, big deals when it comes to ad lib caloric consumption. So protein is number one, energy density is number two. That's basically the mass or weight of the food you're eating. And water is a big contributor. And then volume is a big deal also, and fiber is the biggest contributor to that. So it's basically you want to eat more protein percentage, more water content, more fiber. Protein, fiber, water. You should be chasing all three of those. What worsens this energy density is refinement of carbs and fats. So sugar and oil. It's very easy to add a ton of extra calories with these extremely refined carbs and fats that have a ton of calories and hardly any weight and volume. You can just pour oil on the food of animals and they will just automatically passively eat more calories and get fatter. And you can do that with almost any animal. You can certainly do that with humans. That's what it's called, restaurant food. You just pour oil on everything and people eat more calories. And it's, you know, so this is how part of this dilution is from the obesity epidemic is diluting protein with refined carbs and refined fats. So you're getting way more calories for the same weight and volume and the same amount of protein.
All right, so if I'm eating tuna fish and broccoli, I'm going to eat a lot fewer calories than if I'm eating ice cream all day.
Mm-hmm. Yep, you got it. Exactly.
All right. I mean, I guess I could manage to eat the same calories, but I'm going to be a lot hungrier feeling if I was eating the ice cream versus the high-protein, low-fat, and high-fiber meal. All right.
Yep, absolutely.
So I'm just kind of looking at this list of recommendations. Okay, so here's something you haven't spoken of, because you talked about the top three things. Let's get into some of the other things, like stuff that requires you to need teeth.
Right. Yeah, so oral processing time. Surface hardness. The harder a food is and the more you have to chew it, the higher your satiety per calorie. If I just drink a milkshake, like I can consume a massive amount of calories in like 5 minutes. If I just get a Trenta Frappuccino with whip, I can literally consume like 2,000 calories in, you know, less than 5 minutes. Easy. It's not even hard.
Right. Liquid calories. Right.
Yeah. But if you try to like eat air popped popcorn or, you know, or God forbid, something like celery.
Raw carrots, yeah.
You physically can't do it. Like it takes, you know, I think 2,500 calories from carrots is 18 pounds of carrots. So good luck. I mean, that is just not happening. You'll probably die first trying to do that. So the Trenta Frapp versus the carrots, oral processing time, big deal. Surface hardness is pretty much the same thing. Another way of looking at it. So these are all big deals. So you want to eat something that's less refined, higher surface hardness, more chewing, higher oral processing time. Takes longer to eat, slower. That gives time for the protein amino acids to enter your bloodstream and signal to your brain that you've eaten some protein. It gives time for the lower small intestine gets extended with this weight and volume and water and fiber. So the slower you're forced to eat from chewing, the better. And the higher the surface hardness of the food, the better, because you're having to chew the heck out of it. And these all help quite a bit.
Well, and that probably leads to another one of your recommendations, which I've heard for my whole life, and I've ignored it as long as I could, which was, you know, this idea of like eating slowly and chewing your food well and things like that. And if I'm eating something like, you know, ice cream, well, I'm not chewing it at all. It's just like in my mouth and it's down my stomach and I'm already reaching for another scoop. But if I'm chewing a raw carrot, I've got to chew it pretty good, you know, or I'm going to like injure myself swallowing this thing. So tell us a little bit about the, you know, what is thought to be important just around, you know, mindfulness, I guess.
Right. Now, some of this advice that you hear just parroted by all the nutritionists is kind of good, but then can be taken way too far and is just dumb. So like, okay, chew your food a whole ton. Like they actually did a study where they're like, everyone has to chew every mouthful of food 100 times. We're going to count you with a little clicker. And yeah, people ate less, but the dropout rate was enormous because it was just effing disgusting. Everyone was just nauseated. It was the worst thing ever. So it's such a fail out of the gate. Well, you don't want to make yourself over chew. That's like absolutely disgusting and absurd and needs to die in a fire. But what you want to do is just pick some foods that you actually have to chew and then eat them as fast as you want. Eat your carrots, you know, raw carrots. I eat a lot of raw carrots and apples and food I actually have to chew. And I'm not like counting how many times I chew. That's so stupid. Another thing is like, oh, plate size. Get a tiny little plate. Everything should be on a tiny little plate. That's a horrible piece of advice. No, what you want is the biggest bowl you can get for your salad and the biggest plate you can get for your salmon and your skinless chicken breasts and your protein. Like if you want a serving bowl the size of your car for your salad, that's awesome. if you want a giant serving platter for your whole giant fish that you cooked up, that you're going to eat the whole thing, that's great. What, when you get out of the little plates, it's for dessert. It's like after you've eaten this giant bowl of salad and protein, okay, yeah, get a small plate for your, you know, chocolate cake or whatever. That's a great idea. Love it. So you want to take some of this practical advice is actually grounded in something good, but if you just apply it mindlessly to everything, it's horrible.
Okay, so anyway, maybe the idea is to, one strategy taken to an extreme is not going to do you as much good as all of these ideas used in moderation.
Absolutely, and knowing when to deploy them.
Okay, and also you had talked about spicy foods. What's the deal there?
Oh, right, capsaicin. It's basically a little bit helpful for eating less. There are certain ingredients, I'm going to say, like caffeine, capsaicin, the things you find in green tea or coffee or spicy foods that you do actually eat a tiny bit less. I mean, it's not a big rock in the jar. I think this is just a minor aside. It was like, you know, 0.0001% of the book. I just mentioned it in like a sentence. But these are things that aren't necessarily bad. Like, it is good to throw in some spicy food and some caffeine and some green tea, just if you're really trying to shave the calories down as low as you can get. You'll see a lot of natural bodybuilders and bikini models. They'll go out of their way to just drink green tea all the time. They'll, you know, leverage the heck out of caffeine with their pre-workouts and things like that. They're definitely getting condiments that have almost no calories, but quite a bit of spiciness, like your, you know, your red hot, your hot sauces and your, yeah, you know, things like that. So there is a little bit of benefit there, although that's, you know, that's just a fraction of a percent of icing on the cake, I would say.
My personal experience is that it makes a big difference, the hot sauce does, because mm-hmm. I eat more slowly. I have to, right? It's mm-hmm. it's hurting me. And so I eat more slowly to avoid pain. And by eating more slowly, my body is recognizing how much I've eaten faster, or, you know, I'm taking, anyway, the same pace that it always did, but I'm eating more slowly. So I haven't overeaten by the time my body says, okay, we've had enough.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, you're right. It's like a mindfulness bitch slap when you're eating, and it's for no calories. So, like, definitely exactly. Worth mentioning.
And a lot of flavor.
Yeah, exactly. Not the biggest rock in the jar, but definitely I like it.
All right. So what about, you know, one of the issues, alcohol. So I've sort of long been a believer in not drinking my calories, and you explained reasons for that. But one of the reasons for not drinking alcohol when I'm eating is that I sort of will forget what I'm trying to accomplish. You know, I lose all my inhibitions. And what do you think about alcohol?
Yeah. So one of the biggest problems, well, first of all, it's fairly energy dense. It's, you know, 7 kcals per gram. That's pretty steep. Yeah. I'm almost more worried about what you're going to eat after. So about 2 hours later, you're hungrier than if you hadn't drank at all or consumed any calories. Also, things like soda, these are what we call uncompensated calories, right? So if I give you a snack, let's say I just give you like a candy bar and it's, you know, 200 calories and you eat a candy bar, you are going to eat not quite 200, but less calories at dinner, at your next meal. You'll eat less calories because you're going to compensate a little bit for the candy bar. If I give you 200 calories in soda, you're not compensating for that at all. You'll eat just as much at your next meal as whether you had the soda or not. So that's just like free we're just pouring calories right into your fat cells for no apparent reason. Alcohol is actually worse than that. Not only do you not compensate for it, but a couple hours later, you're hungrier than if you hadn't consumed anything, because wow, alcohol is such a high priority. The oxidative priority is so high, it just shuts off everything else until all the alcohol is gone. And that leaves you kind of hungry afterwards. So it's kind of beyond bad. It's beyond empty calories.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not great. Well, plus it causes, you know, 22 different cancers, literally causes them. It's a known, you know, carcinogen. So, you know, unless you really want, you know, gastric cancer, esophageal cancer, pancreatic cancer, all of your upper GI malignancies, alcohol is a huge driver of all of those. And so it's not really aligned with my health goals.
I guess you don't drink much.
Not a lot. I'll have like one drink every couple months. I'll have like, you know, I could count on the fingers of both hands how many alcoholic beverages I have in a year, for sure.
Awesome. Okay. So the last thing I've got on this, and then I want to move into a topic that's very near to my heart. I want to ask you about your thoughts on diversity of foods. In other discussion topics, that the idea of having a lot of diversity in your food, trying to have 30 different plants a week in what you're eating. And the one way that that seems to be related here is you were talking about nutrients. If you have nutrient deficiencies, then that can make you feel like you're hungry and you're eating trying to get these nutrients that you're deficient in. But if you're just eating the same thing all the time, you're never going to get it.
Right. Well, there's a couple layers to this. First of all, yes, you definitely want enough diversity to make sure you're getting micronutrient adequacy. Now, the lucky thing is if you graph out protein and all of the micronutrients, they track together. They're very linear together.
The whole foods.
Right. All of your vitamins and minerals track very tightly with protein. So if you're eating a protein, you're probably getting enough of everything. However, it's kind of like the plate size thing. When it comes to low satiety per calorie foods, foods that are high in protein and fiber and water, you want to go crazy with diversity. You want to have every kind of lean protein you can get. You want every kind of fruits and vegetables, lean proteins, anything with a lot of protein, fiber, water, huge diversity. You will eat more. You'll enjoy it more. You'll get more micronutrients. This is amazing. Where you don't want infinite diversity is when it comes to low satiety per calorie foods like junk food and garbage, like rodent models, right? Well, like we make obesogenic rat chow in order to fatten rats and mice up in the lab as fat as possible to give them diabetes and drive cardiovascular disease so we can do research on them. So there's all these companies that make obesogenic rodent chow designed to do that. But the very best way to fatten up lab rodents is what they call a cafeteria diet, which is where you feed them a very wide variety of human junk foods. It's like Little Debbie's and Doritos and pepperoni and cakes and pies and muffins and crackers and bagels. And you give them all of these things, a very wide diversity of low protein, low fiber, low water, high energy density carbs and fats together. They're hedonic. You have to overeat them to get enough protein. You want to overeat them because they're super tasty. And the wider the diversity, the more you're going to eat. It's like when you go to the buffet, right? Dessert table at the buffet, super huge diversity. You're eating freaking all of that. You're going to eat twice as many calories. What you want to do is go to the buffet and then really spend time on like the salad bar and the lean proteins. And you can get like a little bit of everything. Amazing. But then if you want a dessert table that just has like one option and you eat that last and you just have like one thing. So you want all this diversity on low satiety per calorie foods that are nutrient dense with a low energy density. But you don't want diversity when it comes to the junk food and the obesogenic rodent cafeteria diet stuff. So it's kind of like, again, just like with the tiny little plates and bowls, you want to apply it on the low satiety per calorie foods, I mean, high satiety per calorie foods and not the low ones.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Well, important distinction. Okay. So I want to move into some related topics that are not exactly, they're not directly satiety oriented. One relates to protein. So high protein is advocated for athletes, people using their bodies a lot and their bodies need to repair and build things over time. And also higher protein is advocated for older people. Maybe they've got anabolic resistance. The idea is slow down the process of becoming frail and falling down and things like that. That does make sense. So for the audience here, the older athlete, well, it seems like they would need more protein. Okay, that's one side. The other hand, there's a lot of people out there who say, well, more protein is faster aging. You know, you're overactivating your mTOR, you're not getting enough autophagy, blah, 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 blah. Have you put any thought into this business of, higher protein causing faster aging?
Well, okay. So there's one huge, huge, huge problem with all of this protein and aging stuff. And that is that most of the time, they're paying no attention to protein percentage. They're just looking at absolute protein. So most people If you ate more protein, you just ate more food and more calories and you're fatter. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's like, show me somebody who ate 200 grams of protein. Oh, that's because they're on my 600 pound life and they eat 6,000 calories a day and they're like, you know, just morbidly obese. So of course, more protein is bad. You know what I mean? And then you've got this like ultra skinny vegan who's just shaving their protein down to like 45 grams a day. They're barely alive. They're like super pencil necked and they're like one slip and fall hip fracture away from dying. But they are, you know, eating very little protein, but very little calories and very little food. And they have very low body mass. And that is kind of a good thing to a point for longevity until you're super old and then you're just frail and you're going to die faster. So that's why you get this U-shaped curve. Where when you're younger, protein's good, and when you're older, protein's good, and somewhere in the middle, protein's bad. And in that somewhere in the middle, nobody's looking at protein percentage, they're just looking at absolute protein. It's a little difficult to tease that out from just eating like a whale, and like just eating like way too much food in general. They try to correct for total caloric intake, but like unless you're really looking at protein percentage, the fact is if you give someone a diet that has a higher protein percentage, they are going to only eat a little bit more absolute protein, but way less calories and just be thinner because they're full on fewer calories. You know what I'm saying? So targeting a higher protein percentage is spectacular. And you might not even eat that much more absolute protein. So I really wish people would spend more time looking at dietary protein percentage instead of like how many grams of protein did you eat?
Okay, great. So let's talk about losing fat. People in the world have been doing the wrong thing for a long time. And so they can't just start eating right now. They need to get their body fat percentage and their visceral fat in particular way, way down without losing all of their muscle and then maintain that. Whether I want to keep putting on muscle without putting on body fat, or if I do have to go through cycles of where I'm bulking, say, and I'm putting on muscle and body fat, then I need to lose body fat without losing muscle. Anyway, this whole thing that you have gone through many times, no doubt, you know, what do you suggest for people?
So personally, I like it just a gradual progressive overload that's very sustainable. And so I'm telling everyone, okay, you know, just start with breakfast. Look at what you eat for breakfast. Okay. Well, of course you eat protein for breakfast. You have one egg every day, whether you want to or not. That's 6 grams of protein. That's like a good start, but you want like 30 grams your first meal at least, right? So my advice is, you know, start really small. Maybe start with just one meal. Just start with breakfast. And eat all the same things you do now, but either find an alternative that's higher in protein and lower in calories, or add in a little protein somewhere. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, okay, you eat eggs and bacon every morning for breakfast. Great. Okay, how about eating turkey bacon instead of regular bacon, or Canadian bacon instead of regular bacon, or ham instead of regular bacon? That's just going to instantly double the amount of protein you had for the same calories. This is like, and it's sustainable. Like, okay, could you go on just a grapefruit diet for the rest of your life where all you eat is grapefruit and, you know, you'll lose some weight initially and then you'll just like quit and it'll just be a total fail and you'll gain all back? Yeah, that's not going to work for most people. But these little substitutions that are, you know, pretty tiny but very sustainable. Like, okay, could you eat, you know, turkey bacon or Canadian bacon every day for breakfast instead of regular bacon? Long term, yeah, I think you could actually do that. What about instead of like 2 eggs, you have 2 eggs and 2 egg whites and make a scramble? Okay, you just quadrupled your protein with your turkey bacon instead of regular bacon and your 2 eggs and 2 egg whites in a scramble. Okay, now we're talking. Now you've actually just doubled the protein percentage of your breakfast. And it wasn't really that bad. Like, you could actually sustain that long term. Sure, it's not, you know, 10 out of 10 delicious. It's like 8 out of 10 delicious. But, you know, come on, like, it might be worth it. And then I just have people kind of whittle through their day like that. You know, if you're drinking soda, you get diet soda. If you're eating just cheap ass white bread, Wonder Bread, switch to like your, you know, Dave's Killer Bread or your Ezekiel Bread, or you're like, you know, something like more, you know, higher fiber, lower refined carbs, lower energy density. Every protein you eat, get something a little leaner, you know, get the non-fat Greek yogurt instead of the full fat. Get the Fairlife fat-free milk instead of the whole milk, you know, ultra-filtered, lactose-free, lower fat. You know, every protein, you're trying to get a little less fat. Every carb, you're trying to get a little higher fiber. It's like, oh, get the whole wheat instead of the white. Get the low-carb tortillas instead of the regular tortillas. And you just kind of whittle through your day making these tiny little substitutions, still eating the stuff you want and you like and you enjoy. But every little thing, you either substitute it out for something that's a little higher protein, a little higher fiber, a little higher water, a little lower in refined carbs and refined fats, and maybe even change the ratios a little. It's like if I eat, you know, 50 pounds of rice and a tiny square of chicken breast for dinner, why don't you eat like a giant chicken breast and a little bit of rice? You know, just like change the ratios, make little substitutions, and it's super sustainable. And like you could do that forever. And you just slowly work on it like that with these tiny little micro substitutions, little additions, little ratioing. And you're just trying to target protein, fiber, water, eat them first, eat them up front, you know, eat them before you eat. Like if you just start out your day with donuts, it's pretty much downhill from there. But if you save the donuts till the later in the day, you've eaten a ton of protein and a ton of salad and a ton of your carrots and your fiber and your water, it's a lot easier to just have a donut instead of just the whole box. Like if I eat a Krispy Kreme for the first thing I eat in a day and I have a whole box there, that box is empty by the end of the day for sure. But if I get in my, like, you know, 150 grams of protein and 2 or 3 pounds of apples and carrots and berries and salad and, you know, stuff like that, okay, now I could have a donut at the end of the day for dessert, you know, actual dessert, yeah. And I can get away with it. And that way, you kind of get to eat whatever you want, but you're just ratioing it and changing the order in which you eat it and, you know, making these little substitutions where you're just trying to incrementally get up the protein percent, the fiber fraction, lower the energy density. It's a little bit low carb and low fat together, always prioritizing protein first and foremost. And that's what I recommend for most people. Now, there are some people who they really like the drama. They're like, I am just going to go carnivore for the next, you know, 1 year. I'll literally eat nothing but red meat and water. Here it goes. Boom. Some people, that's actually motivating for them. And that's fine. Cool. Go for it. But a lot of people just flame out hard and then just yo-yo right back. And so they are probably better off just doing something that's reasonable and sustainable and playing the long game. You know what I mean?
Sure, sure. Okay, so what I'm taking away is that you advocate for people, you know, regular people who have a hard time sticking with big changes to their diet, to not change your diet. Just change out the things that you're eating. You're essentially eating the same foods as you were before, maybe a little different ratios, certainly different products that are going to be more protein, more fiber, more water. And then you don't even have to count your calories because you'll just be less hungry, so you'll eat less without even trying.
Yeah, absolutely. If you want to count something, just how about protein awareness? Try just for a day or two counting how many grams of protein are in everything and how much protein you ate. And then, you know, try to up that a little and eat that before you eat anything else at each meal or in the day in general. And so I love, you know, people to be counting protein initially just to be a little more aware, because then you'll realize, oh, damn, there's no protein in this. And that didn't have any protein either. And holy crap, that only had 1 gram of protein. It's no freaking wonder I'm hungry at 10 a.m., even though I ate breakfast. And so this protein awareness is really helpful. So if you want to count something, try just counting protein for a day or two, and you don't really have to do it forever.
Cool. All right. Well, those are my questions. Is there anything else that you think our audience should hear about? And then we'll get into more about how to find your book.
Yeah. I mean, like, I could talk all day about this, but you really don't want me to. So I think we've hit on all the you know, there's four pillars, basically protein percentage, energy density, which is mostly water, volume, which is mostly fiber. And then hedonics, which is this high energy density carb and fat together. It's low in protein, low in fiber, low in water. That's your donuts. And you're trying to maximize protein, fiber, water, minimize those refined carbs and fats together. And I just spell it all out in the book with all these cute little graphics and things like that. And so then it really just comes down to practical implementation and figuring out what foods you like, what substitutions you can make, what little ratioing you can do. And that's pretty much the diet sorted.
Yeah, it's a great book. It's actually very well put together, so thank you for that. Tell our audience how they can find out more about you.
Oh, yeah, okay, all right. So I'm on all the socials at Ted Naiman. You know, I'm on X and Instagram and YouTube or whatever at Ted Naiman. You can find the book pretty much anywhere books are sold. It's called Satiety Per Calorie. Or you can go to satietypercalorie.com. And if you buy the book there, I do offer a money back guarantee on the, I'm selling the PDF of it there, where if it wasn't the single best book you've ever read on the general principles of diet and exercise ever in your whole life, I just give you a full refund and you still get to keep it. So you pretty much can't lose. But you can also buy it from, you know, Amazon for your Kindle or Apple Bookstore for your iPad or whatever. But I can't give any kind of money back things for, you know, those sorts of things because, like, I have no control over what they're saying.
Fair enough, fair enough. All right. Well, hey, thank you very much. This is very helpful and the book very informative.
Oh, yeah. No, thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, Dr. Naiman, you have a great one.
All right. You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for joining my conversation with Dr. Ted Naiman. You can find more information about Dr. Naiman and his books in the show notes.